Good morning.
Good morning.
Do you hear me well? Okay. Just to be sure, let me see if this one's working. Does this seem to be working? Okay. Well, as you might have guessed, this is not going to be an ordinary day in the house of the Lord. This is a classroom today, so I'm going to act like a teacher, which I don't have any trouble doing, because I was one for a long time. I'm going to talk about God in a very direct way. In the Book of Messiah, on page 220, are some things that you've heard over and over again over the last year and many times before that. But it seems like a lot of presentation of this scripture has occurred recently. And it's about how we obtain salvation. So on verse 12, there it says, "And there is none other salvation save this which hath been spoken of. Neither are there any conditions whereby man can be saved, except the conditions which I have told you." And then there's a list of the conditions. Verse 13 says, "Believe in God. Believe that He is, and that He created all things, both in heaven and on earth." Then it goes on, "Believe it, that He hath all wisdom and all power, both in heaven and earth. Believe that man doth not comprehend all the things which the Lord can comprehend." And again, "Believe that ye must repent of your sins and forsake them and humble yourselves before God and ask in sincerity of heart that He would forgive you. And now if you believe all these things, see that you do them." That's the path to salvation. I hope that we have all come here today to learn a little more about the path to salvation. I'm going to concentrate on verse 13. And I have a good reason for doing this, as I will try to develop before you. Believe in God. Believe that He is, and that He created all things, both in heaven and in earth. I remember when I was growing up on the farm in Minnesota, there was a period of time, one summer, that my father invited a family that had lost their job and their home to come and live with us. And they have converted the upstairs of our house for them. And it was a family with three children, if I remember correctly. There was a boy and a girl, I don't remember their names anymore, who were between my brother John and I in age. And so we had a camaraderie with them. And one night we heard on the radio, that's how I got our news in those days, that there was going to be a meteor shower. So it just happened that there was a hay rack parked in our front yard. And the young people among us got out there in the night, and it was a fall night. It was cool, but pleasant. We laid in that hay rack, and we looked at the sky, and the moon was at a phase where it hadn't come up, and all we could see was stars. I don't see that around here. That Minnesota, rural Minnesota sky was full of stars. And probably a half dozen or more times during that time we were there, we saw a meteor go streaking across the sky, leaving its trail. And I can remember thinking about the vastness of space and the beauty of what we saw and wondering how did God place all of those things. And I learned later that they were are far away. The distances measured in light years, the amount of space light can travel, is at 365,000 miles per hour. I don't remember for sure. I think that's it. At 365,000 miles per hour in the number of days or years that were listed. And I believe the closest star, Betelgeuse, was 3.5 light years away. And the sun is 93 million miles away. Space is vast. And I can remember thinking about those things and thinking, well, who is God after all? What, can we picture Him? Can we name Him? Can we define God in any way? But I found what I think was a pretty good definition in the scripture. And it begins with the words, God is. I have a concordance that has that entry, God is. And under that entry are these things. Numbers 23:19, God is not a man. John 3:33, God is true. John 4:24, God is a spirit. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 9, God is faithful. 1 Corinthians 14, verse 25, God is in you. 1 John 1, verse 5, God is light. 1 John 4, 8, God is love. Moses had a question. You'll find it in Exodus chapter 3. I'm going to read verses 13 and 14. And Moses said unto God, Behold, when I come unto the children of Israel, he had been commanded by God to go back down to Egypt and be instrumental in freeing his people from the slavery there. So he said, When I come unto the children of Israel, and shall say unto them, The God of your fathers has sent me unto you. And they shall say to me, What is his name? What shall I say unto them? And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. I am that I am. It sounds like double talk. Sounds like God was evading the issue. Come on, God, what is your name? He said, I am that I am. And I thought about that. Of course, he's also called the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. You see that over and over again in scriptures, but I pondered this I am business, and I thought of something. If at any time you can ask God who he is, and he says, I am, that means he never had a beginning, and he never had an end. You can ask the same question any time. In all of eternity, and the answer is still the same, I am right now, and God is right now, and he is to me, and he is to you. God is. You know, there are people in the world who would like to take God away from us and instill their God. And we find it all around us, and I want to talk a little bit about that today. And I have some things to show you, which is why I put up the screen. And there's a young man in the audience that I'm going to ask some questions of, so I know that he's prepared. So I will begin. There are things in the heavens and on earth that that we have to consider because others are putting them in our face and telling us lies. One thing is that scene that I saw on the hayrack. And people have studied the span of space, and they've wondered how it came into being and how do you describe it. And so there's a term called anthropic. And if something is anthropic, it contributes to life. So you might hear that term sometime. That's what it means, contributes to life, anthropic. And some writers have written about the fine-tuning of the universe. And they study the movements of things and how they relate to each other and their distances apart and how they change, how they've changed over the span of time that they've been observed. And they see in the whole universe a fine-tuning which contributes to life here. And if any tiny thing were off in that fine-tuning, we wouldn't be here. It would be impossible for life to occur. A man named Penrose says he has noted that a single parameter, the so-called original phase space volume, that's one of the 30 parameters that are anthropic in the universe, required such precise fine-tuning that the Creator's aim must have been precise to an accuracy of one part in 10^10^123. Let me define that a little bit differently. That is 10 billion times itself 123 times. That was for one parameter, but there are 30 parameters that have been identified. So that suggests something to me. That suggests that the whole universe has been designed. It is a machine that works perfectly. And it works in such a way that life is possible. So if there is a machine and it is designed, then there must be a designer. And if there is a designer who bothered to design a machine that works as perfectly as Penrose thought, there must be a purpose for the machine. And that's kind of what I'm getting at here. It isn't just in the expanse of the heavens. No. Because on heaven and on earth. And what do we have on earth? We have living things. We have algae. We have larger plants. We have worms that burrow in the ground. We have microbes. We have germs. And we have human beings. And all of the animals that we know about and associate with. All of them. Everyone has in the middle of every cell, all of our 3 trillion cells, there's a nucleus of some kind. And in that nucleus, there are chromosomes. And in those chromosomes, there is DNA. That's one artist's conception of how DNA is put together. So, Trevor, may we have your presence. Trevor and I are going to have a little conversation here. He doesn't know anything about this except that he was supposed to come up and take a microphone and stand beside me. Okay, where you can see that. Trevor, what is that?
Looks like a strand of DNA.
Right. Are there 2 strands there or something?
Yes.
And did you learn about that in your biology class?
Sort of.
Sort of, okay. And what did your biology teacher tell you about DNA?
He told us that it was 2 strands and they were made up of different things and they, like, it was sort of like opposites, I guess. There was like 2 mm-hmm. letters and they always switched back and forth and then they combined and that's where you get different traits that you have.
Okay. Did your teacher tell you anything about where DNA came from?
Sort of.
Uh-huh.
We went through this subject really quick, the whole DNA, but proteins.
Uh-huh.
Is that something? We didn't go too in-depth into it, just
okay.
Proteins.
Do you see a design here?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this could happen accidentally?
No.
Did your teacher tell you that it happened accidentally?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, I don't think I'll quiz you any further. That's great. Thank you. Anyone else want to come up? No? Okay. Thank you, Trevor. That was very good. Unrehearsed. He didn't know what I was going to ask him, but I knew this would be sort of familiar to him. The teacher said it happened accidentally. I heard that too. It's in all of the textbooks. An accident. Somehow, suddenly, there were chemicals in the sea, and there was lightning flashing, and there was ammonia down there in the water, and somebody devised an experiment. His name is Miller, in which he said, okay, the primordial sea must have had these things in it, so he put them in a flask, and he connected that up to other things, and then he put electric charge in there, and he drained off the water eventually to look and see what was in it. And he found that some of the chemicals had combined. And he said, ah, that's how life began. The chemicals in the primordial sea combined and formed amino acids. And amino acids, if you put them together in the right order, make proteins. And proteins make up all of the enzymes and structural stuff in our bodies. And enzymes do all of the work in the cell, putting things together and arranging things so that they'll work. So he thought he had the answer, but he didn't have an answer for DNA. Still, in class after class, year after year, in spite of all kinds of information to the contrary, Miller's experiment is still used to teach biology students in high school and college that there's a scientific basis for the accidental beginning of life. The scientists know it's not true. They know it. They know that if you're going to have a chemical substance this large and this complex that can replicate itself, there's got to be design. There's got to be a designer, and there's got to be a purpose. When you look at this, this is another representation of the DNA molecule, but it's showing how it divides and how other parts come in and form two strands where there was once one. Every time a cell reproduces in your body, all 3 trillion of them, this process goes on. If they happen to be egg cells and sperm cells, they determine the genetics of the offspring. It's a marvelous plan, a wonderful design. We only have learned a little bit about it recently to understand something about how it works. Nobody knows why a chemical substance is capable of doing this. But every move that takes place here is monitored by an enzyme. And an enzyme is a protein. And guess what? In order to get a protein, you have to unzip a portion of the DNA molecule. And from that, get a template for the specific protein. That goes into the cytoplasm of your cell. In there are some other objects. I'm not going to give you technical stuff here. And there are little messengers around here that run around and pick up amino acids, and they're assembled in this organelle into proteins. According to a code, which is in the DNA molecule, the segment of the DNA molecule that has been transcribed. In order for any of these things to happen, every aspect of it is monitored and moved along by proteins. I think you might begin to get the picture here. For this machine to work, it is self-operating. It is a perpetual motion machine as long as there is life. The proteins start the process, the proteins monitor the process, the proteins finish the process, and the process is making proteins. You get my meaning here? It is a machine, a perfect machine that has been designed. If any single step along the way is missing, the whole thing falls like a house of cards. It will not happen. And so we have what's called an irreducible complex. Is it back on? Okay, good. An irreducible complexity. This is the signal that biologists should have that they're dealing with design. The good news is that there are now biologists and biochemists and other kinds of scientists. Jesus is a son. Okay. So there are a few scientists who are willing to admit this and bring this to the fore. This is not the only area in which you can very clearly see design. Actually, for people who know nothing about biology, this next one I'm going to show you might be the best. Okay, maybe not, huh? Yeah. You see little dots. You see rows of dots? Okay. Those represent the carbon atoms in these compounds. The top one, it represents glucose. Everybody know what glucose is? Am I on here now? No. Now? Must be something wrong with the switch. Glucose is the basic sugar in your food that gives you energy. All energy comes from glucose. So what I'm showing you here is how glucose is metabolized in your body once it gets into the cell. You know that insulin is a protein that makes it possible for glucose to get through the membrane of the cells of your body. If it's not functioning right, you don't get the sugar where it belongs. It stays in your blood. This is called diabetes. And so here we're following the proper trail. And then notice the number of steps that we have here. And it takes these six carbons that were in the glucose and divides them up into two sets of three. And at the bottom, there's a substance called pyruvate that has come from that. Notice the number of steps. If any step is missing, the whole thing will not function. But this is only the first of three phases of it. So here's phase two. It's called Krebs cycle, named after the guy who first named it. So here's the pyruvate. It goes through another process here. The yellow block is a coenzyme, another protein. The coenzyme in the yellow blocks has one very important task. It takes the hydrogen atoms out of the compounds and takes them to another place, which is step three. Notice that when we get here, we have a cycle. Here we have joined the two carbons to four, and we have six. And then as we go through the cycle, my thumb showing on there, there goes carbon dioxide. Another carbon was taken out. Here's carbon dioxide. Another carbon was taken out. And then we have four. For the rest of the way we get here, we have oxaloacetate, four carbons, and it's going to be joined up with acetyl coenzyme A, two carbons, and the cycle will continue. Do you see what we've got here? We've got a machine. It is a circling machine. It just keeps going and going and going, and in the process, there are two things that happen. Various atoms are taken out in order to create that oxaloacetate that will join up with two carbons and continue the process, and hydrogen atoms are being taken away. Also, in the process, there is a formation of another compound called ATP. All of the energy in your cell is supplied by the breaking of a phosphate bond that's attached to adenosine diphosphate. When you attach it, you have adenosine triphosphate, 3. When you detach it, you have adenosine diphosphate, 2. And energy is released. That is a great invention, adenosine diphosphate, adenosine triphosphate. What a great invention. It releases all the energy in your cells that you need to operate the cell. So from eating something with glucose in it and going through this entire process, you have removed hydrogen atoms and you have created some ATP. But you haven't created enough ATP. So what happens to the hydrogen atoms is really the most amazing thing of the whole thing. It goes to what's called an electron transport system, a series of proteins called cytochromes in the cell. All of this happens in the cell, by the way, are given not the whole atom, but the electron from the atom. Do you get the picture? In every cell of your body, hydrogen atoms are being split. And the electron is bouncing from cytochrome to cytochrome to cytochrome down through the series. And when it gets through, it has given up a lot of energy. And the energy then becomes a source of energy to put phosphate groups onto ADP so that you have stored energy in your cell that can be later released by breaking a bond and getting ADP out of ATP again. Everybody follow me? So now we've had this electron bouncing along, giving up energy, and what's it going to do? It's going to be attracted by the proton, because hydrogen has one proton and one electron. It's the only element in the whole universe that can do what I'm talking about. And they will come back together and you have hydrogen again. What? What happened to the energy? The electron was bouncing along, giving up energy, and it comes back to hydrogen, and you've got hydrogen again, and it can go and be separated again, and you've got a perpetual motion machine. Amazing. And this complicated process, I know it sounds complicated, it is complicated. This complicated process is how we get energy in our cells. Did this happen by accident? No! No way that could happen by accident. Any part missing in the whole apparatus would cause the whole thing to fail. So, did this evolve from a simplified system to a more complex system, to a more complex system, to a more complex system until we have what we have in the higher animals and plants? Impossible. It just wouldn't work. You can't have one part missing. So if you're going to add parts to something, that means that in the beginning something's missing. In biology class, they will show you the first phase. And they will say, there are funguses in which this is the only process for getting energy. Except ATP is involved. So they will say that if you go to the funguses, they're the beginning, the first phase of this process. And then, of course, in the higher types of living things, you will begin to get this. Not so. It's true that the funguses use that simpler system, and all the rest of us use the whole complex thing. But you can't go from that simpler system to this without having all of this. And that's a sufficiently complex design right there. You got to have all of it, or you don't have any of it. Now, why am I telling you this? Well, there are two reasons. First, I am looking for appreciation of this God who created this universe. You might say, oh, I do appreciate God. But how much do you appreciate God? How much? And another point I want to make is that there are people lying to you who know what the truth is. They know it. They know that only design can explain this. And they're lying to you. Why would anyone do that? I think I've gotten way apart from my notes. But that's all right. I want to go to Isaiah chapter 40. This is how Isaiah expressed his appreciation to God for these things I'm talking about. He didn't know any of these things. They've all been discovered in the last 20 years. But he had this appreciation. And he expressed it this way, chapter 40, starting with verse 12. Who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and meted out heaven with a span and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure, and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance. Who hath directed the Spirit of the Lord, or being his counselor, hath taught him? With whom took he counsel, and who instructed him, and taught him in the path of judgment, and taught him knowledge, and showed to him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop in a bucket, and are counted as the small dust of the balance. Behold, he taketh up the isles as a very little thing. Yes. Who's going to counsel God and instruct him? But there are people in this earth who have taken that up for themselves and have decided to instruct God and to tell him what he did and how he did it. And they're teaching in our schools, and they're writing books, and they're presenting things on the Discovery Channel. And they're having an effect on the people with power in our government, in our education system particularly. But they're forgetting who it was who can measure the waters in his hand. No human being can do this. We're just a speck on a tiny planet in the midst of this universe that we know nothing about, very little about, whose edges we cannot see, whose beginning and end we do not know. Do you realize that we have discovered that the universe is expanding? And so scientists said, well, there must have been a small beginning and there was an explosion, and the explosion is still happening. I suppose you could describe it that way. But what they have discovered now is that if the expansion were a little faster, it would lose its orientation and become scattered. If the expansion were a little slower, only a tiny, minute bit slower, the whole thing would collapse into a solid mass. Design. It's doing what God designed it to do. Anthropic fine-tuning is in place. So there's evidence in astronomy, there's evidence in biology, there's evidence in statistics, there's evidence every place that science goes for the intelligent design of the universe and of man and of all the things that we know. And why aren't schools teaching intelligent design? One big trouble. In the world we have secularists who are secularists. They believe that there is no God, that the most important thing is the state, and that people should come under the rule of the state. The intelligent ones among us should be in charge, and the rabble should do what they say and pay lots of taxes. Their design for the universe is we know what things should be, and the rest ought to listen to us, including God, if there is one. They're in charge. They have the purse strings, and the scientists are afraid. They don't want to lose the money that comes to them, salaries, funding for research. The purse strings are held by the secularists. But it's going to change. There are now a few scientists who are willing to say design is the answer. They don't want to say God did it, but in their hearts they know that's where it goes. And so they're beginning to step out. Now, why am I telling this to you? What can you do about it? Probably not a whole lot, but I want you to be aware that the dishonesty is beginning to come to an end. We're in a war. But there is a very personal side to this that I'd like to emphasize. And it's an important thing. Where there's a design, there's a designer. Where there's a designer, there's a purpose. We are the product of the designer's design. That means that we have a purpose. God has a purpose in you and I. Now there are people out there, the secularist world has tried to take God away from us. They can't take God away from us because that's not the way things are. God doesn't belong to us. We belong to God. They've got it backwards. They don't know what they're talking about. We belong to God. And He values us. And I want you to believe this. Boys and girls, boys, you have value with God. He wouldn't have bothered to design all this and make a universe and make all of these sounds perfect and working so well if you did not matter to Him. Girls, you have value in God. And boys, when you look at girls, I want you to know that they have value in God. And when you girls look at boys, know that they have value in God. They may act funny and give you trouble, but God values them or they wouldn't be here. We have value. So I want you to think about that. Husbands, your wives have value to God, or you wouldn't have designed them. Wives, your husbands have value. Your children have value. Please do what God has done for us and look at each other and value each other. You're more valuable to God than you think. And the people around you are more valuable than you, to you. That's how God wants us to look at it. Or He wouldn't have given us charity. He wouldn't have given us an association together as brothers and sisters in the church of His Son. He values us. He wants us to value each other. In the fourth chapter of Ephesians, something that we've read many times, I just want you to hear it again. While you're thinking about how God values us and wants us to value each other, chapter 4, verse 1, I, therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you that you walk worthy of the vocation wherewith you are called. God has called us because of the value He places on His creation. We each have a calling, a place in His world. With all lowliness and meekness and with long suffering, forbearing one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. That's our task with each other because we value each other. This is the church. There is one body and one Spirit, even as you are called in one hope of your calling. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all. Does this put it all together for you? One. One with God, one with each other. God is one with His church. One. We're one. So why do we act like we aren't? Because there's another spirit in the world. You ever wonder about that? Why God did what He did? Put a man in the Garden of Eden and then he made a woman and gave her to him. And He said, be fruitful and multiply. Wants the earth to be populated. And He gave us control over everything. We're to govern this. And then He did something really terrible. He gave the man and woman their own free will, So there's a tree in the center of the garden. There's another tree. And you're not to take the fruit of that tree. Oh, sure. He gave them a free will and expected them to keep their hands off of that fruit? No, he didn't at all. Didn't expect it at all. He gave us free will. Actually, that other spirit in the world, Satan, he gave us the ability to choose Satan. You can choose Satan for your master. Be quite glad to lead you around, quite glad to enfold you in his arms, his chains. And our carnal will leans toward that. We have to fight it every day of our lives in order to do what God would have us do. But think of it. Satan doesn't give us any value. Satan didn't have this design that God had. Satan didn't create anything except havoc and dissension and separation. And so why do we listen? So which God do you choose? The God of accidental formation? I had to read my notes where I can see them here. The God of accidental formation and selection, natural selection, whose prophet is Charles Darwin. Or the God of creation, who designed with a purpose, who took on flesh to offer us salvation and teach us his pure love. I want to read something from the book of Messiah. I think it's chapter 8. I have a note on it here someplace. No. I've written down the page number. I departed extremely from my notes today, which is probably very good. And it is on page 251. Abinadi was teaching the people. And verse 28 it says, "And now Abinadi said unto them, I would that ye should understand that God himself shall come down among the children of men and shall redeem his people. And because he dwelleth in the flesh, he shall be called the Son of God. And having subjected the flesh to the will of the Father, being the Father and the Son, the Father because he was conceived by the power of God, and the Son because of the flesh, thus becoming the Father and the Son. And they are one God, yea, the very eternal Father of heaven and earth. And thus the flesh becometh subject to the Spirit, or the Son to the Father, being one God, suffereth temptation, and yieldeth not to the temptation, but suffereth himself to be mocked, and scourged, and cast out, and disowned by his people. And after all this, and after working many mighty miracles among the children of men, he should be led, yea, even as Isaiah said, as a sheep led before the shearer is dumb, so opened he not his mouth. And even so he shall be led, crucified, and slain, the flesh becoming subject even unto death, the will of the Son being swallowed up in the will of the Father." God had such a love for us that he himself came and atoned for the sins which were caused by the free will that he gave us and the other spirit that he allowed in the world. What was God trying to do? He must have been nuts. Well, I'll tell you what he was trying to do. He was trying to establish the purpose of the creation that he made, and we are part of that purpose, and the choices we make are part of that purpose. And while God seemed to do a strange thing here in making this come to pass, it was his way, and his way is the best way. And there's something that you and I have to learn from what I just read, and it is found in verse 34. "Yea, even so, he shall be led, crucified and slain, the flesh becoming subject even unto death," and this is the important part, "the will of the Son being swallowed up in the will of the Father. And we are identified with the Son. He was flesh, we are flesh. He walked the surface of this earth and endured the temptations of it. We walk the surface of this earth. We endure the temptations of it. We must do what He did. The will of the Son, the will that we have, must be swallowed up in the will of the Father. And when it is, we'll be ready for salvation. Not before. So this is our task in fulfilling the purpose that God had in putting us here, is that we look for ways to swallow that will that we might have, our carnal will, to let it be swallowed by the will of the Father, our Father in heaven. We are one here as a church to help each other accomplish that. I hope that today I have given you something to think about and something that will help you to turn your will over to that God who created all these things, who we have so little understanding of. We must say, He's the one who spoke and the void of the earth changed. And He spoke and there were living things on the earth. And He brought all of this into being. How can we fight Him? How can we do anything but turn our will over to Him? I thank you.
Connie has asked to be administered to, and I'd ask Brother Nicholas and Brother Dick if they would take care of that for me, please. Worth of biology could be crammed into 1 hour and then add the scriptures to it as well. Our closing song will be number 267. I'd encourage you to remember the announcements. If you did not pick up a bulletin, grab one. Make the necessary corrections to it so you have all the information you need, and we'll see you here.